could say, well, attention is trending towards planning thoughts, because there's also taste and sound and whatever. So it's, I find that actually interesting. I guess why? Well, I guess because it's dynamic. You know, like, I am planning is a very kind of static idea. But actually when you're witnessing the way things are, it's very dynamic, isn't it? It's changing all the time. And that's what I think I'm trying to encourage, is come to that witnessing state of mind, that knowing. And then if you're having breakfast and you're cultivating awareness and knowing the way things are, and the mind is trending somewhere, you'll notice that. And then you can make a clear choice to, well, no, I think I'll just do taste. I'll change the trend. You know, I'll give some thumbs up to taste. And then we have to keep doing it, because the the trending is the habit. So it's historical in that sense. It's present, but it has this kind of historical momentum. You notice that, and you say, well, why would I not do planning? Well, because maybe it's not necessary. Maybe I'm so preoccupied with planning all the time that it's actually really not productive. Something in me says, well, I just don't want to go that direction. So without rejecting it, how can I create the causes and conditions to not go down that avenue? So that's intelligent rather than reactive, and presence and craft and all those ideas. So then I'm witnessing that. So it's trending this way, and you know, what about taste? Why don't I just do that? So I do taste. So I taste one potato and then planning. Right? So then I just have to re-encourage myself in this practice to I think I'll do taste, thank you very much. and then there's two potatoes, three potatoes, four potatoes. And you can see how if you gently do that, but with some rigor, I suppose, then the tendency towards planning is lessened and the tendency towards presence is heightened. And it's interesting, it's around taste, but the thing about here in this instance is it's not a kind of hedonistic thing. We're trying to milk all the pleasure I can out of a potato. It's not that way. It's just, yeah, it's very gentle and interesting, actually. Whereas our tendency to control usually comes from some kind of aversion or judgment. This is it's quite doable. Obviously, sometimes things are more strong than that. You're not just planning, you're very upset with something. But all of this serves those more dire times. There was a question in the absent box that was quite complicated, and it cited a couple of texts and so on. So to that person, I thought, I wouldn't answer the question directly, but I would suggest not reading for the retreat, up to you, and not stimulating the mind with theory right now, and just come to the sense of it's like this. It's very simple, but if you don't give it a go and you constantly engage in thought, it's not wrong, and one needs an analytical basis for understanding Buddhism, but I think this is a kind of opportunity to not go down that avenue of study right now. And study's good, nothing against it, but right now there's a very special time where we don't have to engage the analytical mind, but we can maybe move towards no thought. Because that's more rare, isn't it? It's a more rare possibility. And one of the things I often reread is Thomas Merton's enlightenment experience in Polnarua. Everyone knows Thomas Merton, Trappist monk, who was great. It's interesting, like Merton, I read him. I mean, I don't get Christianity. I don't understand it at all. to me, it's like, I don't get it. And obviously, Inquisition and so on, to me, isn't Catholicism. I mean, if I think about Catholicism, I think something, there's something deeper. St. John of the Cross or Thomas Merton, or these beings have some profound insights, which I respect. But I don't get it. I really don't get it. And the people come to me and try to convert me and tell me how. But what's wrong with not getting it? You know, because to me, a tradition has to be lived to understand it, rather than just, well, this is what it means, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, I know, I've read it. So it's okay not to get it. But I can certainly respect it. Like, this place, to me, I mean, it's a really generous place. And so, like, I find the icons of Christianity, I prefer a Buddha much, much more. But then I don't have to put it down or take a position against it. I just don't get it. And what's wrong with that? Not getting it. Rather than, anyway. So then I read Merton, and he gets something. But then what I see about Merton, and he's not parochial. You know, he's not a Catholic, or maybe is Catholic in that larger sense, right? And that he had his great correspondence with the Dalai Lama, and he wrote a book, what was it? Zen and the Birds of Appetite with D.T. Suzuki. And so he's got this lovely, lovely mind which uses these different traditions in different ways. So I often reread this passage from his Asian journals. I don't know if you know the story, but he had a very strict abbot. He's a Trappist monk, and Trappists take vows of stability as well as poverty and chastity. We don't have vows of stability. We're wanderers. That's why our Dharma talks wander so much. Sorry. I was a bit too frisky last night. I had too much tea, to be truthful. I was all over the place. Apologies. So Merton's first abbot was very, very strict, and although he was allowed to do lots of publishing, he really wasn't allowed to move around. And then when that abbot died, a new abbot took over, and he was given permission to travel to a conference in Bangkok. And on the way, he met the Dalai Lama, he met Wolpo Rahula, he met Trungpa, and his Asian journals describe this great travel of his. And towards the end of his journey, he went to a beautiful ancient site in the town of Polnarua in Sri Lanka, where myself and Rossini and who else? A bunch of us were in December. Ajahn Sumedho was there. We were there on pilgrimage, 30 of us. And we went to Polnarua. Gaul Vihara is the area, and he describes it here, but we went with Lompo Sumedho, and we had a police escort, of course, as one does. and the policeman helped get Lompo Sumedho onto this rock ledge, which overlooks the beautiful Buddhas carved into the rock. And Lompo Sumedho's balance is bad, so we had him in a wheelchair, and there's myself, Ajahn Pasano, Ajahn Asoku. So he's sitting on this ledge and looking at these beautiful Buddhas and thinking, this is one of my favorite places in the world. A lovely, lovely comment. So Merton was there at the end of his Asian journey, and there's something about this writing that always struck me as inspiring. So let me read it for you. Polnarua with its vast... this is from his journal, so it's not full sentences, just... He was one of the great journalists of the last century. Polnarua with its vast area under trees, fences, few people, no beggars, a dirt road, lost. Then we find Gaul Vihara and the other monastic complex stupas, cells, distant mountains like Yucatan. The path dips down to Gaul Vihara, a wide, quiet hollow surrounded with trees, a low outcrop of rock, with a cave cut into it. Beside the cave, a big seated Buddha on the left, a reclining Buddha on the right, and Ananda, I guess, standing by the head of the reclining Buddha. in the cave, another seated Buddha. The vicar general, so the vicar general is his guide now. He's taking him around Sri Lanka. The vicar general, shying away from, quote, paganism, hangs back, sits under a tree, reading the guidebook. And it's like, yeah, you don't get it, do you? I am able to approach the Buddha's barefoot and undisturbed, my feet in wet grass, wet sand. Then the silence of the extraordinary faces, the great smiles, huge and yet subtle. The reclining Buddha at Polnarua is probably the length of this room, carved into the rock. I'd say maybe longer, I don't know. Rasini, you think? Kind of, yeah. So, you know, like his, the head is probably the height of that doorway. You get a sense of this thing. And then this standing big, okay. The great smiles, huge and yet subtle, filled with every possibility, questioning nothing, knowing everything, rejecting nothing, the peace not of emotional resignation, but of madhyamika, of sunyata, which means emptiness, that has seen through every question without trying to discredit anyone or anything, without refutation, without establishing some other argument. For the doctrinaire, the mind that needs well-established positions, such peace, such silence can be frightening. I'll read the rest of it, but that really kind of has struck me about the kind of limits of thought when we as intellectuals, because we're all intellectuals because we're trained to use thought a lot and we use it for good purposes, but when we limit ourselves to understanding simply through thought, then this, for me, speaks very beautifully to that limitation. So let me read that again. In the cave, another seated Buddha, the vicar general, I am able to approach the Buddha's barefoot and undisturbed, my feet in wet grass, wet sand. Then the silence of the extraordinary faces, the great smiles, huge and yet subtle, filled with every possibility, questioning nothing, knowing everything, rejecting nothing, the peace not of emotional resignation, but of madhyamika, of sunyata, that has seen through every question without trying to discredit anyone or anything, without refutation, without establishing some other argument. For the doctrinaire, the mind that needs well-established positions, such peace, such silence can be frightening. I was knocked over with a rush of relief and thankfulness at the obvious clarity of the figures, the clarity and fluidity of shape and line, the design of the monumental bodies composed into the rock shape and landscape, figure, rock, and tree, and the sweep of bare rock sloping away on the other side of the hollow, where you can go back and see different aspects of the figures. That's where we were sitting with Lumpur. Looking at these figures, I was suddenly, almost forcibly, jerked clean out of the habitual half-tied vision of things, and an inner clearness, clarity, as if exploding from the rocks themselves, became evident and obvious. The queer evidence of the reclining figure, the smile, the sad smile of Ananda standing with arms folded, much more imperative than Da Vinci's Mona Lisa, because completely simple and straightforward. The thing about all this is that there is no puzzle, no problem, and really no mystery. All problems are resolved and everything's clear, simply because what matters is clear. The rock, all matter, all life is charged with dharmakaya, everything is emptiness, and everything is compassion. I don't know when in my life I have ever had such a sense of beauty and spiritual validity running together in one aesthetic illumination. Surely, with Maha Balipuram and Polnarua, my Asian pilgrimage has come clear and purified itself. I mean, I know and have seen what I was obscurely looking for. I don't know what else remains, but I've now seen and have pierced through the surface and have got beyond the shadow and the disguise. This is Asia in its purity, not covered over with garbage, Asian or European or American, and it is clear, pure, complete. It says everything, it needs nothing. And because it needs nothing, it can afford to be silent, unnoticed, undiscovered. It does not need to be discovered. It is we, Asians included, who need to discover it. The whole thing is very much a Zen garden, a span of barrenness and openness and evidence, and the great figures motionless, yet with the lines in full movement, waves of vesture and bodily form, a beautiful and holy vision. So, that has seen through every question without trying to discredit anyone or anything, without refutation, without establishing some other argument. So with one thing you'll notice about spiritual questions, so questions on that level, is that quite often the very answer elicits another doubt. And you're trapped into the well, at least that's what I find with myself. I get trapped into the suffering of needing conclusions. Yeah? And because that's where one finds comfort, if one is very much dependent on intellect. Dependent in a spiritual way. I'm dependent on intellect to analyze how to make something that, you know, I'm not advocating dementia as a path to liberation. Maybe I've got it wrong, I don't know. But in this, say, spiritual sense, you can see the limits of thought, right? That thought's still an object. And so if one is dependent on an object, and you're contemplating Buddha's teaching, that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease and is unsatisfactory. So conclusions in the spiritual sense are unsatisfactory. If I smell a gas leak in this house, it would be good to conclude where it comes from. You know, I'd really like to know that. And that's the realm of thought and analysis and doubt and consideration. But in this way of spiritual endeavor, I would say that can we use thought to take us to no thought rather than to be caught in the cycles of doubt and conclusion, doubt and conclusion, doubt and conclusion. So if you notice that, if that's the way that's the way my mind works, I don't know about yours. So sometimes I can read something very erudite and I'm taken by it in the beginning. I said, wow, I never thought of that. Maybe I should read more. That's where I always go, yeah. And then I read more and then I have more doubts. You know, I mean, I understand the basics, and I have a basis for investigation. But I could see in myself then the whole temptation to find a conclusion, to have an answer, is a kind of false promise, isn't it? It's kind of like if you figure this out, then you'll really, really know. And then, like how many people from Asian backgrounds ask me, how does rebirth work? Yeah, everyone asks that. You know, how does it work? I say, have you ever asked a monk that? Yes, I ask every monk that. Oh, really? So, but they don't get it. That, you know, you give an answer, well, it's like this, this, this. Or you give an answer, I don't know. And then ask another monk. And they don't see that the problem is the question. And that the question can't be answered, but they won't take no for an answer. So they ask another question. So where are intellectual conclusions valid, and where are they simply objects which are pleasant? So if you take the Four Noble Truths, you'll see that there is suffering or there is discontent. That discontent, the cause of that discontent is in attachment to craving, and that the abandonment of craving is the end of discontent. So in this case, what is the discontent of doubt? It's I want confidence. What is the downside of confidence is that it changes to doubt. You cannot remain intellectually confident all the time. But you can remain silent all the time. And that's a possibility within which confidence comes and goes, doubt comes and goes. And then you can use doubt skillfully rather than being constantly trending towards doubt, conclusion, conclusion. So then you have the intellect, I think, in a proper perspective where it is, where its usefulness is appropriate, but where silence actually is more appropriate than thought. And it's very hard, isn't it? Because our if you look at your breakfast, how much of the time was trending to thought and how much time was with the potatoes or whatever you're eating. So the tendency to be engaged in thinking is very, very strong. To try to get rid of thought won't work, but to begin to shift attention more to suchness. And that's what I'm really trying to kind of encourage people to do, is just try that. And the theory's fine, work on it and study it, and it's helpful. But just this little bit about, it's like this moment. So, you know, like in nowadays, there's a lot of talk of we're in a post-truth society, right? Has there ever been a truthful society? Middle Ages, what they did to witches, and they believed it. You know, post-truth society. It's always been BS, hasn't it? Human beings have been always inventing propaganda and all of that. Fake news. So there's validity there and so on and so forth. But like recently I've read stuff about butter and milk. It's all changed. I can now eat real milk, or real butter, right? It's allowed. So who was right? Was that fake news, post-truth society? But what's really true is this moment, like this. And that is not a conclusion. That's more like an observation. and so when we talk about Dharma, we still have to live in this post-truth society with fake news and all the rest of it. We have to somehow navigate ideas and dietary concerns and all of that. Like the whole thing around diet and science around food, that's really interesting to watch, the trending that has gone on in the last 40 years of people have suffered because, you know, they've got an extra layer of fat on their left earlobe or something like that. It's kind of horrible, where you eat food and you think it's poison. It's a really weird society, I find. But anyway, if you're a bit overweight, don't worry about it. Maybe you're not overweight, you know, in 10 years' time they'll say you weren't overweight. But what you can really know is like if you have a kind of self-disparagement around what your body looks like, you can know the truth of the way things are, that's just a thought. It's like this. This is self-disparagement. And that you can see that that's simply a trending. It's not really who you are. There's the silence of knowing things. But if you believe in thought all the time and you come to conclusions which are coming from greed, hatred, delusion, it's very painful, isn't it? You know, you conclude that there's something wrong with you and the information system reinforces that. Young people now with self-image. Gosh, it's horrible, isn't it? The kind of narcissism of selfies. It's like, you imagine thinking about yourself. What's more depressing? Thinking about yourself all the time. Can you think of anything more depressing than that? It is. It's really poor kids, right? So, in our way of being, we're just noticing that the sense of self is a thought. Sure, I mean, you know, do take your statins or whatever you have to take. But notice that any self-image or self-projection or thought is just a thought, it's an object. And that which knows is not an object. Then you start to free yourself from all these really powerful conclusions we make about ourselves or others. They're very painful and kind of unfair or culturally driven, socially driven, media driven. But the whole sense of awakeness is not driven by anything. It's Dharma, it's truth. That's why it's very liberating. So that was a bit of a riff, wasn't it? Let's do some sitting.